Perfect. Just to kind of explain a little bit about what I'm researching. So in light of like the recent COLA movement, we're kind of looking into the history of grad student organizing. And that's in relation to UCSB and also just UC-wide, because it is covered UC-wide due to the UAW's involvement. To start off, I just wanted to kind of get a feel for what your involvement was in grad student organizing.
This was all so long ago, so I have tried to bring some of this back in my memory. It was 2008 or 2009 was the sort of beginning of the budget cuts movement. So the first sort of big cuts from the state of California to the UC, and there were a number of grad. There was a grad student organizing committee at UC Santa Cruz, UCSC, where I was as a grad student, that got involved with that. And there was a big sort of March 4th was the big sort of day throughout the UC. March 4th, 2009, I think it was. We shut down the UCSC campus, and that was and sim so I was sort of, I was involved with that as a grad student, a member of the sort of ad hoc, we called it GSOC, Graduate Student Organizing Committee. But also at that point, I was also the unit chair for the UC Santa Cruz UAW unit. So I think I was elected that in 2008 or 2009. So that was sort of concurrent.
Okay. Perfect. I just want to know a little bit more about what made you want to get involved, like in terms of GSOC and being the unit chair.
It was I think a couple I mean I wasn't when I came to grad school, I wasn't particularly politically active. I wasn't I didn't have a history of activism or organizing at all, and my sort of sense was, I'm just here to keep my head down and do, my graduate work, right? Get my degree and get out. But I think a couple things changed, and one was, I think, the with the cuts, and the way things were in my department and on campus, it was just so clearly unfair that I just sort of couldn't ignore it. Like, this was really this it was a crisis in a sense. And so I sort of felt like, well, I can't, I'd ra maybe I would have rather not been involved, but this is happening, and if I can do anything to push back against this, I think then I'm gonna have to try. And I think part of that came also from a really remarkable organizer who was a few years ahead of me in the history department here, Sarah Smith, and she had been unit chair before me at UAW. And she's just, I mean, she's always just been a really good organizer, and she's very good at bringing people in. And so she sort of, she would call me as the UAW unit chair and say, "Hey, this thing is happening. Will you come to a meeting? Hey, will you come to a phone bank?" And she's just re she was so good at bringing people in and recruiting people. And so, I went to a few GSOC meetings. I did some stuff. I realized, oh, I have time. I have some energy. I can put some effort into this. And then after a while, Sarah was like, "Well, my term as unit chair is coming to an end. Why don't you run to do that?" And so I think a lot of it really was being invited in and recruited by really good, smart, strong organizers and activists who were already here, and there was already a structure in place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you feel like a sense of community within like the people that you were organizing with?
Yeah, I did. I think it was a really good group. And I still remember some of those first meetings, and I didn't really know most of those people, but I didn't feel like I was sort of on the same, like these were really mm-hmm. politically active organizers. Mm-hmm. And I was sort of like, I've never done anything like this. Why, you know, why am I here? Mm-hmm. But they were just so, you know, I think there was a really good energy at that point on campus. Like people were excited. People were, I mean, they were upset, they were angry, but they were excited about sort of getting together and doing stuff. There was sort of, you know, we came up with a sort of a good plan of how we wanted to do things. And yeah, it really felt, and then later in my UAW years, yeah, I got closer to some of those people. And I mean, I'm still, you know, some of these people are still my friends. Like I still, you know, yeah, there really was a community there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And so based on just some of the research that I've done, I read that during like the 2009 to 2010 contract negotiations, you're one of the bargaining members with the UAW. So I just remember that you vocalized some concerns regarding the contract. So I was kind of wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah. There was partly a history there, which was the UAW at that point. We had really significant critiques of the UAW at that point, the sort of statewide UAW. And I think the critiques we had is that it was a very demobilized hierarchical union, like the sort of statewide executive board. They called the shots, and they weren't particularly activist. They weren't particularly interested in member organizing. Like it was very top down. It was more business unionism type style than we would have liked. It was really, and they tended to really want to focus on pay primarily, but they weren't even very good at that in a sense. And the interesting thing is that it really was centralized at Santa Barbara. Like that's where the leadership really sort of had its iron grip. And a lot of them came from my understanding of Santa Barbara has really changed politically since then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Which is amazing. But at that time, like there was this sort of cabal or clique of Santa Barbara UCSB power brokers who were running the union. And there was a lot of friction or tension between them and the Santa Cruz people. So my predecessor, Sarah Smith, felt like her hands were totally tied in trying to organize the grad students at Santa Cruz. So she wasn't allowed to actually even have email list of the members. Like all emails had to come from the president of the union. And there's a story that Sarah tells that, she had no power over her own budget. And so once she requested colored paper because she wanted to make posters for an event, and the president denied her request because the president was afraid that she would use the colored paper to make unapproved posters, like it was really like this top down, the president of the union controls all the messaging, or the president of the statewide controls all the messaging. Mm-hmm. And so we found that very difficult to mobilize and organize membership. And part of the problem with that is that, you know, the statewide leadership, the executive board, and I was on the executive board for a while, they really didn't want to pursue the kind of contract campaign that seemed like we needed to do it. And so I think one of the big issues with that contract campaign was that it kicked off, like the contract campaign kicked off in like mid-April or something, when Berkeley was already getting out for the summer. And then the primary organizing for that contract campaign happened over the summer while all of the students were gone and off campus. And the primary pressure that we intended, that the statewide bargaining team intended, was to put a bunch of names on a, I think they called it a report card, where it's sort of, here are our criticisms of the UC, here are the things we want, sign this. And so I spent hours that summer calling graduate students in my unit and saying, hey, would you sign your name to this report card? You know, and fine, they did. And then in like July or something, like they sent me a big printed copy of this report card, and I had to go to the admin building and hand it over to whoever would come out the door, and there was a photo of it. And this was what this union thought was pressure. Like, this is what they thought was our lever of power. And it was wrong. Like, I mean, it was so not helpful. You know, and so, and at the table, the UC was saying, we don't have any money, we're not giving you anything, you know, we're not, you know, we'll offer you a 0.5% raise or whatever, I don't know. You know, and there were members of the bargaining team from Berkeley and Davis and Santa Cruz who were sort of like, you know, they're not offering us what we need. Like, the salary they're offering us doesn't even keep up with inflation. They're not really giving us the other things we want. And we're not putting pressure on them. Like, this report card thing, the summer, it's stupid. Like, we're putting no pressure here. Like, the thing we need to do is we need to start organizing strike pledges. Like, we need to, and you know, and eventually it was really important for the UAW at that point to settle the new contract before the expiration of the old one. Like, they didn't want to ever go off contract. But in order to strike, you have to go off contract, among other things have to happen. But they really wanted that contract to get settled by the end of September, when the contract expired. Luckily, the UC's offers were so bad that we didn't manage to settle it then, but there was still a lot of pressure, like, no, we're not going to do much more organizing. Come on, let's get this contract settled. You know, and I think it ended up 2% raise or something, which wasn't, I mean, essentially with cost of living, I think it was a pay cut. Mm-hmm. And the bargaining team pushed that through and outvoted those five of us who didn't like that. And in the last few weeks of the campaign, when it was clear that the UAW statewide wanted to settle this contract, no matter what we get, some of the bargaining team, and particularly the members from Berkeley, were sort of like, well, if this happens, we have to put together a vote no campaign. And we have to try and get our members to vote down this inadequate contract. And so that's how that came about.
Was the UAW ever transparent with why they didn't want to go off contract?
They had this, you know, they had this cliche, this thing that they would say over and over again, now that I think about it. And it was just this phrase that they would say, that it was almost like an article of faith, like it was a dogma. And they would say over and over again, our power is at its greatest the day before the contract expires. And no one ever actually explained why they thought that was the case, because that also seems wrong. Like, I don't see any leverage there, or not the kind of leverage that you can have when you're out of contract and can start considering work actions. It was this point of pride with them that they always settled the contract before the expiration of the previous one. And I'm not, I don't think anyone ever adequately explained to me why they thought that is the way they had to go. I mean, my speculation, like, we would speculate that they didn't actually want to, like, it's a lot easier to do it that way, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's a lot simpler. It's more sort of structured, you know, it causes a lot less trouble. You don't ever actually then have to be, you know, I mean, there are some boxes that open if you go off contract, but, you know, potential problems, but, you know, those, you can negotiate around some of those. But yeah, I think they just, I don't think they wanted the chaos. I don't think they wanted the uncertainty. And I think, I mean, I also think they really weren't that interested in any kind of work action, potentially.
Mm-hmm. And when you reference them as like they, are you kind of referencing the executive board or?
Yeah, it would be it'd be the executive board. It would have been the international representatives. So the paid representatives from the UAW International who sort of are tasked with keeping our statewide local on track. And then also the bargaining team who, again, for the most part, I mean, those are the campus leadership positions mm-hmm. on each campus, the two. And for the most part, the executive board and the international reps kind of decided policy. The bargaining team sort of took the cue from them. So yeah, mm-hmm. that's the they here.
Okay. Cool. And then, so whenever the contract was like ratified, between the UAW and the UCs, did all of the members of the UAW have to vote to approve it? What was that process?
Yeah, they did. So they had to vote. Those votes are usually pretty, pro forma. They're usually just, you know, they usually don't even bother to put much energy into turnout because I mean by the time the bargaining team by the time a tentative agreement is reached, like everyone just wants to get it approved and done with. Mm-hmm. But then in that case, in that situation, we decided that our best option, the two Berkeley reps and the two Santa Cruz reps and the Davis rep, we decided that our best option was to try and convince the membership to vote it down. And so we actually did run a pretty decent vote no campaign. And actually the majority at Santa Cruz, the vast majority voted it down, voted against it. I even think, although I don't remember this for sure, but I even think Berkeley may have voted it down majority wise. And so statewide it passed because they ran up big totals down at UCLA and the Southern campuses. But it really only passed, as I recall, like 60%. Which is pretty remarkably low. Like most of the time, contract ratification votes are like 97%. And so it, you know, we didn't win, like the vote no campaign didn't win, but I think it really did show that we had some organizing power, especially at the Northern campuses. I think it made a lot of people mad. Like the Santa Cruz members voted overwhelmingly against that contract, and then they got stuck with that contract. And I mm-hmm. think that really made them angry. And I think similar, a lot of people at Berkeley were upset. Like, wait, this is a terrible contract. We voted against it, but we got stuck with it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was, yeah, I think that was agitational in some ways. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there, did the UAW ever address the fact that like the majority of Santa Cruz and Berkeley voted no?
No. I'm not positive Berkeley had a majority, but it was close. And those numbers must be somewhere, but I know Santa Cruz was. No, I mean, they, you know, they had a press release where they trumpeted, you know, contract passes by 20%, you know, because it was 60-40, right? And so mm-hmm. it was, you know, 20, you know, they had a big trumpeting press release, and then we all sort of um ignored each other for a few months. Yeah, I mean, then we all sort of never talked to each other again. Mm-hmm. Well, because that was sort of, it turned out that was the first sort of skirmish then, because then the following year in 2011 was the UAW elections. And so all the positions on the leadership on the campus and the executive board were all up. And so the vote no was actually sort of the catalyst for a lot of us, especially in the North, to say, we have to take over the union. Like, we have to win those seats. Like, we have to have a campaign. Like, the next step, now that we're stuck with this contract, is to change the leadership so that the next time contract mm-hmm. comes up, we do this right.
So do you think the change in leadership kind of helped push the UAW in a more progressive direction?
Yeah. I mean, I think when, ADU, Academic Workers for a Democratic Union, when that organization, when we won the UAW elections and took over the statewide, you know, I think one thing that happened is, and part of the platform was to give campus autonomy. So, like, campus leaders got access to their email lists. Like, they mm-hmm. could email their members. Like, they could organize their members and however they saw fit. And, you know, there wasn't as much top-down messaging. Like, okay, this is, you know, it was so much more collaborative bottom-up. But then, I mean, I think really clearly going into the next contract campaign, which was, I guess, 3 years after that, 4 years after that, was it 2014? Yeah, I think it was. It was run totally differently. So, you know, the statewide, for one thing, bargaining was run differently. Like, when I sat through bargaining, in 2009 and 10, like, the bargaining team, we would sit in a room, we would never actually go see any of the UC negotiators. Like the international rep would like come into the room and say, this is what the UC is saying, I think we should say this. And then we'd all be like, yes, okay. And then he'd go back and negotiate behind the scenes. You know, it was all behind closed doors. We never actually really had any participation in it. And by the next contract, that was totally different. Bargaining was open. So opening bargaining. And it wasn't just all the bargaining team members were there. It was any member who wanted to come could come. And I, you know, I was, by then I wasn't unit chair anymore, but they actually did hire me to organize for a couple of those quarters. And part of my organization would be organizing people to come to these opening bargainings and have the members show up and tell UC what they wanted and see the horrible things the UC was saying, you know. And then I think we also really organized actions on the ground. So when bargaining came to the various camp, you know, that was another thing. Bargaining used to, would often take place off campus, but when ADU ran bargaining, they had to come onto campus, and then we would have our members show up and, you know, demonstrate outside or march, you know, and show power in numbers, show mobilization. And also, as I recall, we let that contract expire. And we had several strikes. We had a ULP strike, you know, and a part of my organizing then when I was on the payroll to organize then, you know, was organizing for that strike and getting students to turn out for that strike and not cross the picket line. And so I think we did a lot. We mobilized and organized the members. We went past contract expiration. We really made it very unpleasant for the UC, like very unpleasant for them. And I think in the end, we got a better contract than we would have gotten. Like, actually, I think a really good contract, as I recall. I don't remember the numbers, but the raises were better than had previously happened. Mm-hmm. Then my understanding then is this last contract, things kind of went bad. But I was already gone from the UC at that point. So yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Yeah. And that's like another thing that I'm curious about. So like, I'm going to be interviewing more like UAW members. regarding that. So I think those are the majority of the questions that I've had. I think one important one, though, is what is your opinion on the current color movement? And kind of, like, why do you think it emerged even with, like, all of our negotiations with the UAW and everything?
Yeah. So this is from a bit of a distance, because, I mean, I still live in Santa Cruz, but I don't teach it at UCSC anymore. Most of my friends and connections there have moved on. And so, you know, I've gotten some updates. I run into people around town sometimes, and, you know, I see stuff on Instagram. I mean, I'm all for the COLA movement. I'm excited about it. I think it's really exciting. I think part of my understanding, and again, this may be imperfect, is that the most recent UAW leadership has been a bit more cautious, and maybe agreed to a contract that not everyone was very happy about. And I think one of the things that may have activated, again, was this sort of Santa Cruz resentment, because we are such a small union, or a small unit within the broader UAW. And we don't, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, we didn't feel like our concerns were being taken seriously, like we were being paid attention to by the bigger union, like we just sort of got dragged along. And I think I think it's really hard to be a grad student in Santa Cruz, and I imagine in Santa Barbara as well, right? Like, cost of living is terrible. It's not, you know, even though it's a small town, we don't maybe sort of feel like we get the respect and prestige that, you know, the Berkeleys and UCLAs do. I do think that it sounds to me like I think just general grad student dissatisfaction has been building at Santa Cruz as the place gets more expensive and all of that. But I think it seems that that they felt like the UAW leadership wasn't taking them seriously, wasn't giving them what they needed, wasn't bargaining the kinds of contracts they needed. And so they sort of felt like, you know, we're going to take this into our own hands. Our union isn't going to do this for us. And so we have to do this without the union.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's, again, my sort of outside understanding.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm going to kind of jump back just a little bit. So during your time at organizing, I was just curious, like, because I know you mentioned, like, the representatives from different campuses, but in your opinion, like, how involved do you think, like, grad students in general were with, like, the direct actions of the UAW? And, like, by that I mean kind of, like, in terms of contract negotiations, like, how many do you think were, like, invested with and, like, aware of what exactly was happening?
I mean, that's a good question. And I think that's a hard question. I think in the 2009-2010 campaign, not a lot. Because essentially I think the sense of the idea from the statewide was, you know, let's ask our members to do as little as possible, essentially. Like, let's call them and ask them to sign a report card, you know, and that's really all we're comfortable asking them to do. So I think there was a lot of demobilized members then. You know, it's harder to say in the next campaign under Audu, like, what that looked like, especially on other campuses, because I was mostly just focused here, you know, but, you know, we were turning out several hundred people at Santa Cruz for various things. You know, that was about, you know, when we struck, I think half to two thirds of our unit actually, and I'm sure it was much lower at other campuses, which are much larger, but I think the mobilization was higher. I mean, again, I still don't know, you know, I think there's still lots of graduate students who don't know what's going on and don't pay attention and do sort of keep their heads down and just sort of you know, they're there for them, for their degree. And so they aren't. But yeah, so I think it's hard for me to estimate.
Okay. Perfect. So I think those are all my questions. Do you have anything you'd like to add regarding anything that we talked about?
No, I think, I mean, that sounds about right to me. Yeah. Are you talking to other people from that old time era? Who are you talking to? Or can you tell me?
Yeah. So I've actually, because most of my research has been going through like old student journalism reports and stuff. So I've been like kind of trying to like track down people. And there was a grad student organizer, I think he went to UCSB, but he was also talking about like concerns regarding like the UAW and like contract negotiations in 2007, I think. And that was like one of the earlier contracts. So I reached out to him and we're going to set up an interview to like discuss what happened back then too. And then I also have a couple interviews with like UAW leadership lined up just to kind of like see what happened on their end. Yeah, because there's definitely like two sides to like what happened during the time. But I think the main thing that like I want to talk about is not really about like the divide, but more so how like both groups are kind of fighting towards the same goal, but in like different methods. Okay, cool. Thank you so much for meeting with me.
No, you're welcome. Yeah. Thank you. It's a fun project.
Yeah.
So I wish you luck on it.
Thank you. And also, I was just wondering if you perchance have any access to like pictures of any of the organizing that you did during that time. It was a while ago. Yeah.
No, I'm sure I do. Somewhere on my hard drive, I bet I do. Could glance through some of that.
Okay. Yeah. If you have the time and you could just send some over, that'd be great. But if not, it's okay too.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you for meeting with me.
No problem.
I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. You too.